residence on Baker Street, shabby but genteel. She put in her earbuds to finally continue listening to her podcast. This one was about H.H. Holmes, the Chicago serial killer. They would discover the many rooms of Holmes's murder castle, the rooms fitted with gas lines, the hanging chamber, the soundproof vault. She'd marked one of her boxes with stars, and she opened this one now. This box contained the bare necessities of her life, her mystery novels, at least a carefully curated selection of a few dozen essentials. These were lovingly arranged on the bookshelf in the order in which she needed to see them. The chute to the furnaces in the basement where the bodies could be. Sherlock Holmes on top with Wilkie Collins. Then Agatha Christie spread over two shelves, leading into Josephine Tay and Dorothy L. Sayers. She worked her way down to the modern era and ended with her books on forensics and criminal psychology. She stood back and examined the overall effect, then tweaked until the arrangement was just right. Where her books were, she was. Get the books right and the rest will follow. Now she could address the rest of the room. Acid, a collection of poisons, a stretching rack. Stevie was less concerned about the day-to-day items like her clothes. Stevie had very little interest in clothes and no money to buy them anyway, so her wardrobe tended to jeans and plain t-shirts. She coveted a heavy fisherman's sweater because the detective in her favorite Nordic noir wore one, and preferred a sensible cross-body bag like the one worn by her favorite English TV detective. She did have one prized possession in terms of clothes, a vintage red vinyl raincoat, straight out of the 1970s, which she had found at the back of her grandmother's closet. It fit Stevie as if it had been made for her, and she decorated it with a selection of tiny lapel pins, honoring her favorite bands, podcasts, and books. The coat had deep pockets and a thick belt, and when she was wearing it, Stevie felt powerful, prepared, and extremely waterproof. Even her mother, who disliked Stevie's taste in clothes, was on board for the red raincoat. Finally, some red. She was hanging the coat in her closet and had just closed the door when she turned and saw the zombie. Stevie often read that actors look a little different from the general population because the camera distorts appearances. Someone who looks good on camera looks so good in person that reality starts to bend a bit. This was the case with the figure standing in Stevie's doorway. It was a guy dressed in a white linen shirt and a pair of bright blue shorts, looking like a wandering J. Crew ad in search of a glossy spread. His face was unmistakable. When she had seen it last, it was grim, covered in dirt, frequently crying. Now it was smiling gently. His features were soft and rounded, happy cheeks, a small, playfully rounded nose, a dimpled chin. His brown hair was longish on the top and fell in easy waves. His brows had to be artificially shaped. No arch that arched existed in nature. He looked toned all over, but his calves were particularly so. His calves, in fact, had outgrown the rest of him. Beefy calves.
"Hey,"
he said. His voice was deep and smooth and rich, like what gravy might sound like if gravy could talk, which, luckily, it cannot. Gravy might have a nice voice, but the conversation would probably be dull. "You're Hayes Major," Stevie said.
"Yeah."
He chuckled in a soft, self-deprecating way that Stevie was pretty sure wasn't truly self-deprecating. Hayes was a YouTube star. At the start of the summer, he had released a 10-part online show called The End of It All, about a survivor of a zombie invasion. All of the videos were shot from a basement bunker, just Hayes to the camera, discussing his survival in something called the Hungry City, a beachside town that had a few pockets of human resistance. His show was one of those things that wasn't there one moment and was everywhere the next. Stevie had known Hayes went to Ellingham and that she might see him at some point. She did not expect to see him standing in her doorway as she unpacked. She didn't know he would be in her house.
"Sorry, I was on the phone," he said. "I was talking to some people in L.A.
He held up his phone as if indicating the presence of tiny Los Angelinos inside of it. It wasn't clear to Stevie why he was apologizing or even explaining why he had been on the phone before she had seen him. But she nodded anyway, like this made sense. Maybe this was something celebrities, Hayes probably counted as an actual celebrity, did. They talked on the phone, and then they told you about talking on the phone.
So, hey, he said, is there any chance you could give me a hand?
Stevie blinked in confusion. With what? She asked.
My stuff.
Oh, Stevie said, feeling the cold hand of panic on her neck. Already she sounded like a slack-jawed idiot. Sure. She followed him to the common room, where his bags and boxes, nicer than hers and more of them, were waiting. He gestured to a box.
You have to be careful with that one, he said.
Stevie took this as a cue to pick that box up. It was a bit on the heavy side, full of some kind of equipment that was unevenly packed and slid around when she moved it.
Yeah,
he said, taking a smaller bag and heading back down the hall to the right circular stairs at the end.
It's been a weird summer. That's why I was on the phone.
Oh, Stevie said. Yeah, sure. She tried to maneuver the box into the twisting space. The steps creaked loudly and the box caught. Hayes moved ahead, but Stevie was stuck trying to pivot and angle without shaking the box too much. She paused for a moment, expecting Hayes to come back and give her a hand. But when he did not appear, she took a deep breath and persevered, letting the box scrape along the wall. Hayes's room was Minerva 6 at the very end. It was much like hers, but hotter and with an extra window.
Oh, great, he said. Set it anywhere, thanks.
Your show is good, she said. I really liked it. This wasn't entirely true. The show was okay, at best. In preparation for coming, Stevie had watched all the episodes. They weren't long, maybe 10 minutes each, and they were fine. The story was pretty good. Hayes's acting, less so. Most of it was cheekbones and a low, sultry voice. Sometimes that's all that was required. Stevie always tried to be truthful, but she didn't want to make her first acquaintance in her new house and say, "Your show was mediocre and overrated, but I see why you are valued, for your looks and deep voice." People tended not to warm to that kind of thing.
"Thanks," he said,
leaving the room in a way that suggested she was to come with him and get more stuff. This was good. This was Hayes Major, internet star, talking to her. Also, this was Hayes Major, internet star, getting her to carry most of the heavy stuff. But still. Another weird thing, Stevie thought, as she made her way back down the twisting steps. She knew about Hayes's love life. Hayes had been involved in a publicized altercation over the summer at some convention when he got involved with another YouTuber named Beth Brave, star of a show called Beth Isn't Here. Beth had been dating Lars Jackson from a show called These Guys. Some kind of argument broke out when Hayes got together with Beth that had been widely recorded, and the three of them had a screaming fight in a hallway. There was online chatter after speculating that Beth would be involved in a second season of The End of It All. This was the kind of life Hayes led. It was very different from Stevie's life.
People in L.A.,
he said unprovoked as they picked up some more boxes.
There's been a lot of interest in the show for movies, so...
He let that hang in the air until Stevie said, "Wow."
"Yeah,"
he said.
"My agent wants me to make another series right away because there's a lot of interest right now."
Another trudge up the tight steps. "More zombies?" Stevie asked as she caught her breath.
"I don't know. You can just put that on the bed. I mean, I did that already."
"You turned into one at the end," Stevie said, "I think. It was kind of open-ended."
"Yeah,"
he said, and his tone indicated that he was no longer really warming to the conversation.
"So, I just have to make a few more calls now that I'm here. Thanks a lot. I'll see you around."
"Yep," Stevie said, wiping the sweat from her brow as she backed out of the room. "I'll see you, here." He was already dialing. As she stepped out into the hall and went down the stairs, two things occurred to Stevie. The first was that it was 8 in the morning here, so 5 in the morning in L.A., on a weekend. While they may keep strange hours in Hollywood, it seemed unlikely that Hayes was doing a bunch of important business at that time. The second was that even though he lived in the same building as she did, Hayes Major had never asked her name. April 13, 1936, 7:15 p.m.
We have your wife and daughter. Do exactly as we say if you want them to live. Do not call the police. We will know if you have. We have eyes on the police station. Take 25,000 out of the safe. Come out to the lake yourself. Get into a boat with the money and come to the island. You have 15 minutes.
The line went dead. 3 men stood in the butler's pantry. Albert Ellingham had the telephone. Robert McKenzie and Montgomery, the butler, stood at the door. Albert Ellingham replaced the receiver on the hook, and thick, frantic quiet followed.
Montgomery,
Ellingham said quietly.
Have Miss Pelham secure the children at the school. Everyone back in their houses, doors locked, curtains drawn. Everyone is to go inside. Do this now, Robert, with me.
Robert McKenzie again trailed his fast-moving employer to his office. Once inside, Ellingham shut and locked the door, then went to the French doors and looked outside. The dark had come down over the mountains. The dark had come down everywhere. Ellingham marched to one of the bookcases in the windowless wall. He pulled down a book from a top shelf, but just halfway. There was a telltale snick, and the entire panel of wall gave. Ellingham swung back the bookcase, revealing a massive vault inside of the wall. He entered the combination and turned the lock. Robert, meanwhile, ran from window to window, pulling the curtains.
We have to call the police, Robert said. We have to call them now. Find a lamp and light it for me, Ellingham said, pulling out several bags of cash. There are still a few workmen on the property, Robert persisted, pulling the massive curtains that swept over the wall of French doors at the back of the room. We could have them out in 5 minutes, surrounding the property and out on the roads. Some of them have shotguns. All of them are handy enough. Robert, there is no time for this. I am taking this money out to the lake. Light a lamp and then help me count.
Later, when asked about this moment, Robert McKenzie would say that there really was no time to think. That was the genius of the demand. No time to think, no time to plan. He grabbed one of the oil lamps kept in every room of the house, power loss was frequent, lit it, and then dropped to his knees and started to count money. In the end, there was 23,000 and a few extra 20s.
It's not enough. We need more.
For one of the first times in his life, Albert Ellingham sounded desperate.
I only have 5 more minutes to get this outside. We need something.
One of America's richest men raced around his office for a moment, pulling open drawers, looking for piles of cash he certainly didn't have, or anything that might be worth that much money.
It will have to do,
he said. The bag of cash only weighed maybe 20 pounds. Ellingham hoisted it and opened the French doors. Robert paused before handing him the oil lamp.
You know they can take you out there. It's probably you they want. Then they'll have me. And then what?
Robert said.
This is madness. We need help.
Albert Ellingham took a crucial second's pause.
Marsh,
he said.
Call him at home. Don't say what's happened. Just get him up here on some pretense. No one else, do you understand? No one but Marsh.
Robert nodded. Albert Ellingham took the lamp and stepped out into the Vermont mountain fog, carrying a bag of money. He walked the 50 or so yards to the lake edge, where there was a small dock. He set the money into one of the rowboats he had moored on the side facing the house, and got inside carefully, then put the lamp on the empty bench seat. When he knocked the edge of land away with his oar,
His entire body was shaking. Still, he reached the mound in a minute or two and threw the rope around the mooring post.
I'm here,
he called into the dark. A flashlight shone down on him, blinding him for a moment.
Get out,
said a voice.
Bring the money.
My wife and daughter, where are they?
Stop talking.
Ellingham threw the bag. It landed on the narrow strip of grass around the dome. He got out as well as he could, considering that he could barely see. The person kept the light squarely on Ellingham's face, forcing him to look down and shield his eyes. He half crawled out of the boat onto the ground.
Open the door,
the voice said. Ellingham pulled his keys from his pocket and opened the door on the side of the dome. This dome was his little thinking place, his island of peace. The person shoved him hard, pushing him into the dome, where he landed on the floor.
Put the money in the hatch,
the voice said. The person was speaking through a scarf, so it was muffled. There was an accent there, an accent he was trying to hide by pulling out the words in a strange way. His pupils were still constricted from the light, so Ellingham felt blindly along the floor, feeling for the hatch. He found it and opened it and pushed the sack into the hole. He heard it knocking some bottles off the shelves as it fell, and they shattered on the floor. He turned back to the stranger, but the light was shoved right back into his face, blinding him again. Ellingham battled with himself for a moment. Should he lunge for this person? Just take him down now, beat his head into the side of the stone base of the observatory floor, and demand with every blow where his family was? Fear and rage came in equal measure. But Ellingham had not gotten as far as he had in life by giving in to every impulse.
It's everything I had in the safe, he said. I was under 2,000 short, but we gave you whatever we had. If I'd had more time, you can have whatever you want, anything you want.
Something came down on his head, and then all faded to black. 4. After making such a huge impression on Hayes Major, Stevie paced her room for a few moments and reviewed her introductory strategy. More confidence. That's what she needed. When she joined the FBI, she was going to need to walk up to people and shake their hands, look them in the eye, ask questions. Hayes had just caught her by surprise. Her next chance was already here, kicking a laundry basket brimming with sketchbooks, pencils, oil crayons, and paints sitting by the door. A girl, the presumed owner of the foot, followed it in. She wore a faded, shrunken yellow t-shirt from an auto repair shop and an old cheerleading skirt in deep blue with red internal pleats. Her legs were covered with little bruises and nicks, nothing serious looking, more like the kind you would get by trying to climb trees or other objects. Her feet were just about covered in a pair of scruffy, red cloth Mary Jane slippers held together with safety pins. Her hair was the real statement piece. It looked unwashed and matted, and it had been gathered in little bunches around her head and tied into bundles with what looked like baby socks. Down her left arm was a long tattoo, one massive line of elaborate script. Down her right arm were notes and sketches in different colors of pen. It is hot as balls in here, the girl said in greeting. Balls, seriously. When the hell are they going to get some AC? Stevie stepped forward, considering offering a hand for a handshake, and opted instead for a casual lean against one of the chairs. I'm Stevie, she said. Stevie Bell. What's up? The girl said. I'm Ellie. There was no Ellie on the list of Ellingham students, but there was an Element Walker. And this person looked like an element. Ellie, or Element, kicked a box that contained feather boas, a ukulele, a bowler hat, and a lot of plastic storage bags full of used makeup, and spilled glitter across the floor. Can I help? Stevie asked. Ellie shrugged, but seemed happy enough with the offer. Ellie's things were a lot scrappier than Hayes's or Stevie's. Two old cardboard boxes, an oversized army duffel bag, a gold backpack,
and a lumpen black laundry sack. It didn't take long to deposit these items in Minerva 3, which was down by the turreted bathroom.
Pix!
Ellie yelled as she dragged the last of her things into her room, then walked back to the common area.
Why is it hot as balls in here?
Note to self, Stevie thought. You could say balls to teachers here.
It's summer, Pix replied, coming into the common room. Hey, Stevie, I left your parents out on the tour. They'll be back soon. And Ellie, the heat won't last long, and then you'll be freezing, so you can look forward to that.
Why don't they get air conditioning?
Ellie said, dropping heavily into the hammock chair. She spun around and turned herself upside down, letting her head hang off the bottom, dusting the floor with her hair bunches.
Because this is an old building with old wiring, Pix replied. Because fire. How was Paris?
Hot, Ellie said. We went to Nice for a while. My mom has a new boyfriend and he has a place there.
Paris. Ellie had been in Paris. Obviously, Stevie knew that Paris was a real place that real people went to. Her school sponsored a French club trip the last summer, and she knew three people who had gone on it. It was only a week long, and the biggest story out of it was that Toby Davidson got hit by a bike and almost lost a finger. Almost lost a finger. The Toby Davidson story. Not a compelling read. There were shuffling noises by the door, and Stevie turned to see another person there. Though it was blazingly sunny, he had the look of someone caught in a rainstorm with a heavy backpack on. He wore a t-shirt that said, "If you can read this shirt, you are too close." His eyes were a strange pale gray. He had a shock of red blonde hair that had been cut by someone with more enthusiasm than skill.
"Nate," she said.
"Out with the hand. Meet his eye. I'm Stevie." Nate looked at her outstretched hand and then at Stevie's face, seemingly to check if this was a serious gesture. With a sigh that probably, wasn't supposed to be audible, he shook it once and let it go quickly. Stevie decided to drop the handshake move. Pix greeted Nate and got out his key, while Ellie examined him from her upside-down position.
"Nate's a writer," Stevie offered. "He wrote a book, The Moon Bright Chronicles."
"Never read it," Ellie replied, "but that's cool. What about you?"
"I read it," Stevie said.
"No," Ellie said. "You, what do you do?"
"Oh, right," Stevie said, brushing away her mistake.
She borrowed her technique from one of her current favorite TV detectives, Sam Weatherfield of Stormy Weather. Sam never got stuck on moments like that. She always moved with the flow of conversation and didn't try to walk against the current. It was time to declare herself for what she was. She had considered many terms. It was too presumptuous and silly to say detective. She wasn't any kind of law officer or private investigator, and she had never really solved a case. Crime buff just sounded like a weird hobbyist with a high gloss. Crime historian wasn't quite right and was definitely too dull. Her solution was not to give herself a title, but to state an activity. "I study crime," she said.
"To do it or stop it?" Ellie said.
"To stop it," Stevie said, "but it probably works either way."
"So you came here because of the crimes?" Ellie said. "The murders?"
"Kind of," Stevie said.
"That's cool. Someone should. They're good murders, right?"
She did half a backward somersault out of the chair. Her skirt stuck up in the back, revealing her butt. Ellie had simply accepted her, just like that. For a moment, it was all endorphins and rainbows in Stevie's head. That was all it had taken. One nice, accepting word from another student, and she realized it would all be okay. And yes, they were good murders. Then she caught something in her peripheral vision. Her parents were coming down the path with another pair of parents, most likely Nate's. Nate's parents were very angular people, crisply dressed in near-matching polo shirts and long shorts. The colors were different, but the effect was the same. Stevie's dad was talking and gesticulating, and her mom was nodding. Nate's father was listening, and his mother was scanning the house and the middle distance. The endorphins fled the scene and were replaced by cold sweat.
What were her parents saying? Were they talking about their views on the media, that the government was trying to control the lives of decent Americans? The myth of climate change? Or was it something more fun, like the price of bulk toilet paper? These were all favorite topics and all equal possibilities. Stevie looked to Nate, who was staring at the door like he was watching an approaching cloud of locusts. He was also feeling the strain of parents meeting parents. Ellie was now scratching her exposed butt. Well, not the butt, but the upper leg part where it meets the butt zone. Technically thigh, but butt for all legal intents and purposes. Stevie gripped the chair and braced for impact. "Did you see a moose?" she said to Nate, in an attempt to make some kind of conversation.
"What?"
he said, which was fair enough. All of the parents arrived at the door in a knot and trickled through into the common room.
"Just avoiding the toll roads,"
Stevie heard her dad say. The conversation had been about the trip, most likely. That was probably very dull, but safe. Then 8 parental eyes turned to the exposed butt on the floor. Ellie rolled into a seated position just a few seconds too late. Her matted, baby-socked hair stood on end for a moment. Nate's parents showed no outward sign, but Stevie saw her parents take it in. Her father looked away. Her mom's mouth twisted into a small, confused grin. "Let me show you what I did to my room," she said, hooking one parent by each arm and hustling them down the hall.
"What in God's name was that girl wearing?" her mother asked, a little too loudly, as Stevie shut the door of her room behind them.
"I've never seen anything like that get up before," her dad added.
Stevie's parents labored under the belief that what a person was wearing had a direct correlation to their worth as a human being. There were normal clothes, good. And there were nice clothes, very good. And there was everything else. Ellie had just reset the limits on this last category. "Did you like the campus?" Stevie said, smiling. "Isn't it amazing?" That the campus was amazing was undeniable, and her parents made a clear effort not to dwell on Ellie and instead focus on this mountain paradise of mansions and fountains and art and natural beauty.
"We're going to have to head back soon," her dad said. "Are you set?"
On that, Stevie had an entirely unexpected emotional pang. Her parents were about to leave, which was something she had known about and, frankly, wanted. But now, in the moment, there was a hot rush of feeling. She gulped hard. "Okay," her mother said. "You have your pills? Let's just put eyes on the pills." Stevie's plastic bag of medications was produced and examined. "You have 120 Lexapro and 30 Ativan, but only take the Ativan if you need it." "I know." "But if you need it, make sure." "Mom, I know. I know you know. And you call us every day."
"You be good,"
her dad said, hugging her hard.
"You need us, you call. Doesn't matter the time."
Her father looked genuinely on the verge of tears. This was the worst. Bells did not cry. Bells did not show feeling. This had to stop.
"Remember," her mother said into her ear, "you can always come home. We'll come up and get you."
Her mother's final little squeeze said, "This isn't the kind of place you belong. You'll see. You'll be back." 5. After a few moments of not crying, but a lot of blinking, and staring at her medications before stashing them in a drawer, Stevie emerged from her room to find that Janelle Franklin had arrived, and Nate was nowhere to be seen. Janelle was shorter than Stevie had pictured. She wore a red floral romper, and her braided hair was wrapped in a scarf of yellows and golds. She wore a light, summery perfume that trailed in the air behind her as she hurried over to wrap Stevie in a hug.
"We're here," she said, clasping Stevie's arms. "We're here. Are your parents here?"
"They left a few minutes ago. Are yours?"
"No,"
Janelle said. "They're both on call today, so we did all my goodbyes this week. Family dinners and friends, we had a picnic." Janelle happily chatted about the many events that had led up to her departure. She came from a big family in Chicago and around Illinois. She had three brothers, two in MIT and one at Stanford. Her parents were both doctors. Come see my room. She grabbed Stevie by the wrist and led her next door to a very similar room, but with everything flipped around. Their fireplaces were back to back. I'm probably going to need more space to build on, Janelle said, but I think I can use that table in the common room. Pick said I could solder out there. Can you believe we're here? I know, Stevie said. I feel kind of dizzy. I think that might be altitude, Janelle said. We're not super high. The highest point in Vermont is only 4,300 feet, and altitude should really become an issue at 5,000, but you may still need to compensate for the lower oxygen levels by drinking a little extra water. Here. She opened her bag and removed a fresh bottle of water, which she pressed into Stevie's hand. I think I'm just nervous, Stevie said. Also possible. Water is still the answer. And deep, slow breathing. Drink. Stevie opened the bottle and took a long sip as instructed. Water never hurt. Is Nate here? Janelle asked. He was. I guess he went upstairs. How is he in person? Kind of like he seemed in his messages, Stevie said. Well, we're here in person now. Come on, let's go see him. Janelle had entirely changed the energy of the place. She was movement. She was action. Stevie found herself carried along in Janelle's wake as she hurried down the hall and up the tight circular stairs. Nate was in Minerva 4, the first one along the hall. The door was shut, but he could be heard moving inside. Janelle knocked. When there was no immediate answer, she texted. A moment later, the door opened a bit and Nate's long face appeared. He didn't do anything for a moment, and then, with a barely audible sigh, he opened the door enough to let them in. Do you do hugs? Janelle said.
Not really,
Nate replied, moving back. Then no hug it is, Janelle said. How about salutes? Stevie said.
Those are tolerable.
Stevie gave him a salute. Nate's room was more or less identical to theirs, except it was already a mess. There was a rat's nest of cables on the floor, and a pile of books. He'd been organizing his books, just like Stevie had.
The Wi-Fi here sucks,
he said by means of a greeting.
Cell signal, too.
He kicked at the pile of cords with a Converse-clad foot. I haven't tried yet, Stevie said.
Well, it sucks.
The box nearest to Stevie looked to be full of parts. Just parts of things. Chair legs, some kind of metal disc. Janelle went over and had a look at it. What's this? She asked. Do you build too? Nate swooped down on the box defensively.
I go to flea markets, he said, waving his hand as if this was just something that needed to be dealt with. I collect things. I like clocks and stuff.
He closed the box lid and with it, any invitation for further comment. Stevie enjoyed Janelle's brisk, confident positivity, and she also liked Nate's grumpy demeanor. She had a little bit of both of these qualities, and she fit between them very comfortably.
Tour's starting,
Pix called up the stairs.
They're waiting outside. Come on, you guys.
Nate looked hesitant, but Janelle was not giving up. I think it's mandatory, she said. Janelle, Nate, and Stevie made their way outside where a large group of people was milling around in wait. Hayes and Ellie, being second years, obviously did not have to go. It looked like the group went from house to house collecting members, and Minerva may have been the last stop. Stevie looked at her fellow first years. She wasn't quite sure what she had expected, if she thought the students at Ellingham would all show up wearing lab coats, or they would all look like Ellie. In general, they looked like any assortment of people from any high school. There were a few people with glossy, perfect hair who had already clumped together through that strange alchemy that joins all people with perfect glossy hair. There was one girl in a bright red and white check vintage dress with cat-eye glasses, winged eyeliner, a red vintage purse, and a tiny red fascinator. She was the most dressed up, and her heels sank into the grass as they walked. There was another girl with green hair and a NASA t-shirt, who handled the grassy terrain in her wheelchair with deftness. There was a girl with a sharply cut black bob, pale skin, and vibrant red lipstick who looked like some kind of silent movie star dressed in a formless but somehow unmistakably fashionable gray dress and thick black belt. There was a girl in a stunning floral hijab who took a lot of pictures of the campus on her phone. There was a guy who never took off his cat ear headphones during the entire tour. Their tour was led by a student named Kazim Bazir, who spoke quickly and excitedly. Kaz had bright, excited eyes and the upbeat tone of a salesman who really wanted to sell you your very own deranged mountain retreat.
Ellingham Academy was built between 1928 and 1936 by Albert Xavier Ellingham and his wife, Iris Ellingham, Kaz said. The right side of the campus, where our houses are, is known as Wet Campus because the creek turns and borders the property. The fields and classrooms and most of the other buildings are on dry campus. Of course, it's all a dry campus.
No laughs. Tough crowd. Ellingham was splendid in the sunshine. That was the only word for it. The light fell like rain in droplets that hung in the air. A cloud of them surrounded the fountain that gushed merrily on the green, creating its own ecosystem of rainbows. The light found every nook and crook of the bright red brick buildings. It made the gargoyles seem to smile. It deepened the green of the trees. It made the statues... Well, it didn't do anything to the statues except reveal just how many of them there were.
Do you think these get less creepy with time?
Nate asked as they passed yet another cluster of naked Greeks or Romans. I hope not, Stevie replied. Kaz led the group around the pathways, pointing out all the buildings and their uses. Albert Ellingham had been a massive admirer of Greek and Roman culture. This was evident from the names of the buildings. Eunomia, Genius, Jupiter, Cybele, Dionysus, Asteria, and Demeter. As they walked through the green, Stevie looked up at the Great House. Its name was simple and accurate. The Great House was a character in this tale. The first building erected on this spot, designed to meet the whims of the family who inhabited it, while serving as the center of a seat of learning. This was the home Iris and Alice Ellingham left that morning, down this very drive. Stevie counted the windows on the second floor.
What's up there?
Janelle asked.
You're looking up there really intently.
Right there, Stevie said, pointing at two of the windows on the left. Those are the ones Flora Robinson said she was looking out of the night of the kidnapping.
Who's Flora Robinson?
A friend of the Ellinghams. Iris Ellingham's best friend. She was suspected for a long time because she gave a weird story that night. Her interview was really odd. There was no time to linger on Flora and her story. The tour was moving toward the Ellingham Library, a stone structure that looked a bit like a church, with a large rose window, a spire, and a rounded set of red double doors.
It's designed this way on purpose, Kaz said. Albert Ellingham said knowledge was his religion, and libraries were his church, so he built a church.
Inside, the library was cool and still, with colored light streaming through the stained glass windows. All of the buildings were impressive, but there was something majestic about this one. There was an overhang that filled about half the space, but once you got past this, much of the building was open, and you could see up three stories to the bookshelves that lined the structure. Elaborate spiral staircases made of wrought iron, woven into patterns of twisting vines, led up to the other levels. Out of all the buildings, this one should probably have been the quietest and the stillest, but this one seemed a bit... Stevie struggled to catch the right word. Wild? There was a loose wind spinning around and whistling near the ceiling. The iron vines seemed to genuinely crawl up the steps. The librarian, who seemed to have just run in, was out of breath. She wore a very professional-looking biking outfit, and her short black hair bore the imprint of a recent bike helmet.
Hey, she said, sounding a bit winded. I'm Kyoko Obi. I'm your librarian. I also run a cycling club. We all do double duty around here. Sorry, one second.
She took a long drink from an Ellingham-branded reusable water bottle. We have about 500,000 books on site, she said, both here and in storage. We have access to millions more digitally. We're partnered with most of the Ivy League libraries, so we can get you more or less anything you require. It's my job to get you anything you need. Stevie turned that over in her mind for a bit. One good thing about being from Pittsburgh was that the Carnegie Library was one of the best in the country. She had been able to get loads of books and materials there. But here, there might be things related to the case, things not available anywhere else. Stevie wanted to stay, but Kazim was moving them on, all the way across the campus, to a large circular tent structure that looked semi-permanent.
This is the study yurt, Kaz said, pushing back a heavy flap that served as the door.
The floor of the inside was covered in a mix of beautiful woven rugs and piles of pillows and beanbags.
A lot of people sleep in here, Kaz said. It's for studying, but it has all kinds of uses.
The girl with the bob laughed knowingly, a girl with short silver hair, a longer chunk of which poked straight up at the forehead, was lingering nearby. She wore round glasses, white overalls, and a short tank top underneath. She had been trailing Janelle, Stevie, and Nate for several minutes. The sun came out from behind a cloud, bathing all of them in strong, burning summer light. The girl tapped on her glasses, and the lenses darkened. Magic, she said.
Transition lenses, Janelle replied with a laugh. Photochromic plastic.
Vi Harper Tomo, the girl said to Janelle, extending a hand. And I am magic. Something flashed between these two that was almost visible to the naked eye, which caused Stevie a second of panic. She had just met Janelle. Janelle was her best bet at a closest friend, and already someone else was coming into the frame. Which was a crazy thought. Stevie tried to push it out of her mind and focus on the prize of this tour, an inside look at the Ellingham Great House, the Ellingham's former residence. She had studied the photos of the house for so long, seen the floor plans, knew the history. But instead, Kaz walked them right past it.
Aren't we going in? Stevie asked. End of the tour, he said,
walking them past the walled garden and back into a clearing in the trees to a large, sprawling modern building of raw Vermont wood and stone. It had a high, peaked roof like a ski lodge.
This is the art barn, Kaz said. This is the only building that was added to the original campus, and it keeps getting bigger. They're adding to it now.
The ground around one side was dug up, and the construction looked new. Stevie couldn't help but note that the building bordered closely on the walled garden, the famous walled garden that held the lake where the Ellingham ransom drop had occurred. The garden gate was open, and people wearing hard hats were passing through. Stevie craned her head to look, but the tour was moving on into the art barn. There would be time. She would get in.
The art barn isn't just for art,
Kaz said while walking backward.
Everything kind of happens here. Yoga and dance, meetings, some classes.
Kaz was never so excited as when he was talking about the eco-friendly construction of the art barn, the bamboo floors, and the locations of composting toilets. Stevie began to twitch from anticipation. After what felt like an hour-long lecture on sewage, they left and walked back to the great house. When they stepped inside, Stevie stopped breathing for a moment. The house was built around a massive foyer, with balconies on the upper floors looking down over the space. Before her were the master stairs, sweeping up to the balcony of the second floor, and from there twisting elegantly up to the third. On the wall at the top of the first level of stairs was a massive painting, done by the famous painter and Ellingham family friend, Leonard Holmes Nair. The setting was the lake and the observatory in the background, at night. Though that much was clear, the style was borderline hallucinatory. Iris and Albert loomed in the foreground of the picture, mythical figures in swipes of blue and yellow. Iris's short black hair seemed to spread from her head and weave into the branches of the trees. Albert Ellingham's face was merged with the full moon that hung over the observatory and spilled light onto the lake. They looked away from each other, their expressions stretched, their eyes pulling long, their mouths almost rectangular. Stevie had seen many images of this painting. Online, it wasn't that impressive. But in person, it gripped her and held her attention. It was disturbing. There was something about it, something that seemed to haunt the shadows in the background, something that seemed to be behind the observatory. This was painted 2 years before the kidnapping, but it seemed to foretell the doom that was on the horizon, and that the observatory would be part of it. The painting seemed to preside over everything.
"Meet Larry,"
Kaz said, indicating a man who sat at a large desk next to the front door. He was an older, uniformed man with salt and pepper hair clipped into a crew cut.
"I'm Security Larry," he said. "It's what people call me. It's what I answer to. I'm head of security for all of Ellingham. I already know all of your names. I get to know everyone before they arrive." "Security Larry knows everyone," Kaz said.
Security Larry didn't look excited by this interruption.
"We're very secure up here. But if you ever need us, you can hit the blue button on the alarms you'll see in the campus buildings and on some light poles. The rules here aren't hard, but you have to follow them. If you don't, I'll show up. I live just down the path at the gatehouse, so I'm always here. If something says keep out, that means keep out. It doesn't mean go in because someone dared you or because you heard about other people going in. Some of the original features of the property are no longer structurally sound. You may get in, but you may not get out. We've had people stuck for days, so they were starved and terrified before they were expelled. You've been warned."
"What does that mean?" Janelle said quietly as Kaz waved them toward one of the front rooms. "Original features aren't sound." "He means the tunnels," Stevie said, "and the hidden passages." On the right side of the front door, opposite Larry's desk, was a day room with magnificent painted panels depicting twisting vines and pale roses, all decorated in delicate raised plaster patterns in silver. The furniture was upholstered in violet silk, and the floors were covered in a massive decorative rug. This was an 18th century room the Ellinghams had imported from Lyon, France. The furnishings, the rugs, the curtains, and wall decorations, all of it had been boxed up, shipped to America, and resized and assembled here. The next room, the ballroom, had a set of glass double doors, the panes set in an elaborate Art Nouveau style. The doors were partially open, so Stevie pushed them all the way and stepped into a massive room in front of them that stretched up 2 stories. The floor was patterned in black and white marble diamonds. The walls were slashed with floor-to-ceiling mirrors, sculpted and framed in delicate silver. The wall panels depicted scenes of costumed players in masks. The floor-to-ceiling rose-pink curtains were like theater curtains. The ceiling was painted in the light blue of early evening, with the constellations and the representative figures all in gold. Most of America's high society danced in this ballroom in the 1930s.
"And this,"
said Kaz, leading them to a massive oak door,
"was our founder's office."
The office had massive proportions. It was 2 stories high. But unlike the echoey main hall, this room was thickly carpeted from end to end in a lush, deep green, and over that there were Persian rugs. By the fireplace, there was a leopard rug, head and all, that was obviously and disturbingly real. Long windows stretched up to the ceiling and were covered in heavy satin drapes that blocked the sun. The second story of the room was entirely bookshelves, with just a walkway around for access. The fireplace in this room was made of a rose-colored marble. 2 massive desks filled one side of the room. One held 6 sleek black rotary telephones. There was a spinning globe that Stevie guessed contained the names of countries that had long ceased to exist, giant wooden file cabinets, and a strange piece of furniture with tubes coming out of it that Stevie recognized as being a dictaphone, an early 20th century recording device. Dictaphones were big in a lot of mystery stories. This was where Albert Ellingham worked out the plan to try to save his family. They had counted the ransom money on this floor. She could have spent forever in this room. but they were being ushered out again into the foyer. A man in a blue and white striped seersucker suit, with an Iron Man t-shirt underneath, came bounding down the steps in a slow-motion run. His fine blonde hair was swept to the side and bounced a bit as he came down each step.
"And now," Kaz said, "to welcome you all, the head of the school, Dr. Charles Scott."
"Welcome, welcome," he called. "I'm Dr. Scott. Call me Charles. Welcome you all to your new home. I say I'm the head of the school, but I like to think of myself as the chief learner."
"Oh my God," Nate mumbled under his breath.
"As you're at the end of your tour," Charles said, "we need to say a word about Alice. Alice Ellingham was the daughter of our founder, Albert Ellingham. Alice is technically the patron of our school, and we open each school year with a thank you to her. So please join me in saying thank you, Alice."
It took a moment and some gesturing for everyone to realize that this was serious and literal. Eventually, there was a mumbled, "Thank you, Alice."
"That was cult-like,"
Nate said as they walked back to the green, where a picnic was being set up.
"Why did we just thank a dead child?"
"It's all in the rules," Stevie said. "The school belongs to Alice Ellingham if she ever turns up. We're all technically here on her dime, so we have to thank her. She's supporting us."
"But she's dead,"
Nate said. "Almost definitely," Stevie replied. "She was kidnapped in 1936, but this place is hers. If she is alive, and if she appears. She'd be old, but she could be alive, technically." "That really is a thing?" Janelle said. "I thought that was a myth." "Really a thing," Stevie said.
"You said you know a lot about it,"
Vi said. Vi had drifted out with them. "Oh, Stevie knows it all," Janelle said. "Go on, tell us." Stevie had the strange feeling that she was being called on to perform, like a dog that knew how to use an iPad. At the same time, she now had an audience of people who wanted her to talk about the things she loved, and that was a foreign and delightful feeling. The sun was warm, and the grass was springy, and all around her was the scene of murder. They were heading toward the green, but the walled garden was just there behind them. Stevie turned to have a look. The garden door was still open just a bit, and there was no one around.
"Come on," she said. "I'll show you."
"Are we supposed to go in there?"
Nate asked.
"It's open," Vi said, stepping ahead.
The garden door was heavy and black, and passing through it had the quality of a dream. They stepped into a massive, lush garden, surrounded by a high, perfectly spaced ring of trees. The grass was a brilliant, saturated green. The great house stood at one end, with the low stone patio leading down to the lawn. There were small fountains and elaborate benches and planters. It was a regal garden, designed by people who took cues from the royal gardens of England and France. But there was one major thing that really stood out. Most of it was a giant hole, covered in lush grass.
"What the hell?"
Nate said.
"That," Stevie said, "was a lake. Iris Ellingham was a champion swimmer. This was her pool. Albert Ellingham rerouted a stream to fill it, and there used to be rowboats to go out to that." She pointed to a knoll in the middle where there was a round structure with a domed glass roof. "That's the place the kidnappers had him go to drop off the money," she said. "After Iris and Alice were kidnapped, people used to contact Albert Ellingham with all kinds of theories. I think a psychic told him that Alice was in the lake, so he drained it. She wasn't there. But he never refilled it. It probably reminded him too much of what happened. He left it just like this."
"They call it the sunken garden on the map," Vi said. "I see why."
"Explain the dead child thing," Nate said.
"The deal is this," Stevie said. "The school and all the Ellingham fortune belonged to Alice, but Ellingham kind of knew she was dead even if he couldn't admit it to himself. When 2 years had passed, he reopened the school."
"And people came?" Vi said. "After the murders?"
"It was a one-off," Stevie replied. "And it was still the Depression, and this was one of the most famous places in America. Free school from one of the richest men in the country, that was a huge deal. And no one thought the kidnappers were coming back. They'd kind of taken everyone there was to take, so This school was supposed to be a beautiful thing for Alice to come back to. Albert Ellingham wanted the place to be lively. He was sort of making sure there were people for Alice to play with.
That's really grim, Janelle said. Sweet, but grim.
So how many millions of people said they were Alice?
Nate said.
Before DNA testing, everybody must have claimed they were Alice.
That was a thing, Stevie said, nodding. But Ellingham had a plan. Alice's nanny was devoted to her and the family. She refused to give up any details about Alice. Ellingham had a secret file made of information about Alice so that if anyone came forward, they would be able to check.
What, like a birthmark or something?
Stevie shrugged. That's the point. No one knows except the people in the trust, and they can't inherit. The people who run the trust are Alice's keepers. I mean, now they'd just use DNA, so the secret Alice file doesn't really matter as much.
It's good to know we're going to the most morbid school in America, Nate said. Now let's go. I'm hungry, and I'm still pretty sure we weren't supposed to come in here.
Again, Vi said. Gate was open. We probably should go, Janelle said. But this is amazing. And it was amazing. For so many reasons.
April 13, 1936, 8 p.m.
Flora Robinson had a well-developed sense of impending trouble,
a skill she had developed in her time working at a speakeasy. You had to be able to feel the ripple that went through the room when the police were approaching the door. You had to know a false alarm from the real thing. You had to develop the reflex to hit the alarm button at just the right moment, that button that tilted the shelves and opened the chute and sent hundreds, or sometimes thousands, of dollars worth of booze and glass down into a hidden disposal area. Do it right, and you saved the club from closure and all the patrons from arrest. Do it wrong, and you simply ruined everything. Flora could taste fear and anticipation in the air tonight. She turned and looked at the little silver clock on the side table. Iris and Alice had been gone for a long time. She'd seen them off at noon. Usually, when Iris took her drives, she was back in an hour or two. She'd been gone 8. No one had called Flora for dinner. This break-in routine made Flora extremely uneasy. There was trouble around, somewhere in this quiet mansion tucked up in the mountains. She sat on her bed in her room, hugging her knees, listening and waiting. Her keenly tuned hearing and the acoustics of the house meant she heard the arrival at the front door. Iris was back. She slipped out of her bed at once and went to the edge of the balcony to see what had kept her friend. Instead of Iris, the butler was ushering in a man. It was George Marsh, a close family friend and member of the intimate Ellingham circle. Normally, George would have come in and made small talk with Montgomery as he handed over his hat and coat. Tonight, the hat and coat stayed on, and the two of them walked briskly and silently toward Ellingham's private office. George was a former New York police detective. Several years before, he had saved Albert's life when an anarchist placed a bomb in his car. Full of gratitude and impressed with his wits and courage, Albert called J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, and recommended that George be taken on as an agent. George tended to be wherever Ellingham and his circle were. If they were in New York, he worked out of the office there. If they were in Vermont, George would be moved up to Burlington to work on smuggling cases coming down from Canada via Lake Champlain. George Marsh was Albert's de facto security man, and tonight Flora could see he was here on business. Off duty, George was loose and gregarious. This was on duty, George, his step quick, his tone clipped. George and Montgomery were speaking in very low tones, but Flora could make out a few words.
35 minutes, George said. Have you?
No, sir, Montgomery replied. No police.
Within a few seconds, he was ensconced in Albert's office along with Montgomery. Police. Not a word Flora wanted to hear. She had to act. She went down the servants' stairs to the floor below and then made her way to Iris's dressing room by keeping close to the wall. She pulled a key from the pocket of her dress and unlocked the door to a large room, an oasis of comfort. The pearl-gray carpet was soft under her bare feet. The long silver satin curtains were still open, and pale moonlight seeped in, causing the gold trim and threading on Iris's Louis XV furniture to take on a gentle glow. Iris had so many things. Flora needed one object in particular. She started at the mirrored makeup table, where Iris's extensive collection of cosmetics were kept in rigorous order by her maid. Lipsticks lined up like soldiers, French perfumes pleasingly arranged, silver hairbrushes and mirror tidily side by side. Flora tore into the drawers of powders, shadows, hairpins, creams, lotions. Where was it? Not in here. She moved on to the chest of a dozen drawers that housed Iris's gloves, hatpins, cigarette cases, sunglasses, and any number of small accessories. Not in there. She worked the room, steady and fast, drawer by drawer, until everyone was exhausted. Flora heard knocking on the doors down the hall, and her name being called. The maid was looking for her. There wasn't much time. She had to think. Where had she seen it last? An evening bag. The pink silk one they'd gotten that day in Paris when it rained so much they